none of the states on the West Coast or Hawaii have registered any increased level of radiation.
Alaskan officials respond to fears of radiation from Japan's failing nuclear plants. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 14th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, officials investigate poaching from a muskox herd near Nuiqsut.
To lose some from that, it really hurts the stock, especially when they're trying to get them healthy.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
As Japanese officials struggle to contain three nuclear reactors damaged during Friday's massive earthquake and resulting tsunami in their country, Alaskans and other West Coast Americans are increasingly concerned about the possibility of radiation contamination if reactor fuel rods melt and leak from their current containment. State agencies are monitoring radiation detectors in place in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau. State Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zedek says the Western Seaboard is safe.
None of the states on the West Coast or Hawaii have registered any increased level of radiation.
Zedek says that's not expected to change.
We'll continue to monitor the situation. If things change, we have the lines of communication open with a full range of emergency responders and health officials. We'll circulate emergency messages through the media, using the emergency alert system, and by contacting local government officials.
Stories of Japanese citizens taking iodine tablets to avoid thyroid absorption of radioactive iodine has prompted Americans to wonder if they should do the same thing. State Department of Health spokesman Greg Wilkinson says the tablets, potassium iodide, is not something that should be taken as a precaution here.
Actually, the physical side effects of taking it can be just as bad as those of radiation poisoning. They include nausea, they include diarrhea, vomiting. So, no, we are not encouraging people at this time to go out and purchase potassium iodide, or KI as it's called, tablets and begin taking them.
Because of the state's propensity for seismic activity, both Zedek and Wilkinson urged Alaskans to focus on earthquake and tsunami preparedness rather than worry about radiation. A plan is in the works to add some additional radiation monitoring stations in remote locations in Alaska. It's not yet clear when this will happen or where they will be. A former Juneau lawmaker will be sentenced tomorrow on a single charge of knowingly helping or participating with unregistered lobbyists engaged in lobbying activities. Bruce Wyrock was told by District Court Judge Keith Levy that he could spend as much as a year in jail or pay a $1,000 fine.
To the charge of participating in, aiding, or abetting a lobbyist, engaging in activity as a lobbyist without being registered. How do you plead?
Guilty, Your Honor.
Besides yes or no answers to routine questions, Wyrock said nothing else. He rushed out of the courtroom with his wife to sign paperwork in the clerk's office and then left the courthouse through another exit. His attorneys, Doug Pope and Ray Brown, declined to comment until after tomorrow's sentencing. Wyrock's plea will be in exchange for federal prosecutors dropping their case against him. He was initially charged 4 years ago with conspiracy, attempted extortion, bribery, and honest services wire fraud. That case was due to go to trial in May. Last year, the U.S. Supreme Court narrowed the definition of honest services fraud so that it only applied to people in positions of public trust who take or offer bribes and kickbacks. It no longer applies to a non-disclosure of a conflict of interest. Wyrock represented District 4, or Northern Juneau, in the State House for 4 years, starting in 2003. The panel charged with redrawing legislative boundaries has its first meeting Wednesday. Rural Alaskans and Alaska Natives are worried they'll lose representation in the 60-seat legislature after the redistricting board comes up with a final map this spring. KTOO's Matt Miller has the story.
The redistricting board is constitutionally mandated to draw new boundaries after each U.S. census. That's to account for population shifts and ensure that each district is proportionally represented in the state house. Board Chairman John Torgerson, a former lawmaker himself, says they've already received last year's preliminary data.
We got our total population was 710,231, so we know that each district is 17,755 people.
That's an increase of over 2,000 people per district from the previous census. But that won't be evenly spread throughout the state. Detailed data has not been released yet, but most of the increases are expected in South Central or urban Alaska, with population declines in rural Alaska. Legislative boundaries will have to be redrawn according to natural geographic features and municipal boundaries, with districts as contiguous and compact as possible. And each district should also have a relatively integrated population based on socioeconomic factors.
Clearly, there are minority districts that we have in the state, and by the Voting Rights Act particularly, we have to draw boundaries that do not collapse minority districts. And I think we've got six minority districts that are over 50% minority, so you draw boundaries that maintain those six minority districts.
Senate districts should include two contiguous House districts. The five-member redistricting board was intended to be a nonpartisan panel with members appointed by the governor, Speaker of the House, Senate President, and Supreme Court Chief Justice. All members this time are Republicans from some of the biggest communities in the state, except one. Kotzebue's Marie Green is the only nonpartisan. How they redraw boundaries could have a big impact on the makeup of the legislature for the next 10 years.
A focus for us is really to empower Alaska Native people to participate in the process of redistricting, to empower people and inform them about how they can participate.
Liz Medicine Crow is director of the First Alaskans Institute's Alaska Native Policy Center, which is studying the redistricting process. Rural communities, already seeing an exodus of residents, may be incorporated into more densely populated districts.
Yeah, I think that's a concern that that anybody who cares about rural Alaska and village Alaska and Alaska Native representation is really aware of.
For example, Angoon may be incorporated into another southeast Senate district with a sitting incumbent in a more populous anchor community. And that would essentially end the legislative career of Senator Albert Kukesh.
I don't think it's fair for Alaskans to expect a person who was born and raised in urban Alaska to understand the complexities of rural Alaska.
Kukesh's district includes a long swath of rural Alaska from Metlakatla up to Fort Yukon and over to Marshall in the west. It's bigger than some states, but he expects it will be carved up by the redistricting board.
The reality is that if you lose four natives, for example, or four rural seats this year, three of them could be native and one could be a non-native person who I think lend a lot to the diversity of the legislature, and it lends a lot to the diversity of the opinion in the legislature.
Detailed data from the U.S. Census Bureau is expected this week. The redistricting board meets Wednesday at 411 West 4th Avenue, the old Sunshine Plaza in downtown Anchorage. Torgerson says the general public is welcome at all their meetings around the state. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Hollywood zombies invade Talkeetna.
So it's very much like Mad Max meets Dawn of the Dead.
Max of the Dead.
Max of the Dead.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Indian Trust land IIM account Indian Trust account $3.4 billion settlement settlement website amun indiantrust.com amun biu mountain 1-800-961-6109.
The Iditarod leaders are resting in White Mountain this evening. John Baker arrived at the checkpoint just after 4 this afternoon. Ramey Smith followed in at around 5 p.m. The mushers take a mandatory 8-hour rest in White Mountain before making the final push into Nome. It's possible this year we'll see a finish in record time. That is what Elam race judge Jake Berkowitz is predicting.
The record has pretty much been broken already this year. Unless a big storm comes up or unless one of these guys falls apart, they're going to be looking at about a 8-day, 20-hour race.
That would shatter Martin Boozer's trail record of 8 days, 22 hours, and 46 minutes set in 2002. A large crowd welcomed Baker into Golovin as he made his way up from Golovin Bay, and airplanes circled aloft. While the weather along the coast is still sunny and warm, the wind did pick up. Hans Gott arrived in Elam around noon, sitting in third place. He wore his white windbreaker pants and jacket, fluttering in the wind.
Nothing. I think I'm out there now.
Jake Berkowitz says the wind is Baker's ally at this point.
I'd have to say the advantage always goes to John when there's wind, so I'm sure he's happy to see some wind, just training out of Kotzebue, and dogs are used to wind. I'm sure he'd even like a stiffer wind, but... John looks like he's in the driver's seat right now.
Behind the three front runners are Dallas Seavey, Hugh Neff, and Sebastian Schnula, all out of Elam this afternoon. Officials say a number of musk oxen were illegally killed near Nuiqsut on March 6th. The animals belong to a herd in northeast Alaska that has been dwindling in number for the past 2 decades. KBRW's Jake Neer has the story.
Wildlife troopers say they're conducting an ongoing investigation into the deaths of 4 musk oxen in the Alpine oil field near Nuiqsut. They say they can't comment on the details of the investigation, but are calling the killings deliberate and illegal human actions. Trooper Dan Dahl is the lead investigator in the case.
It's an unfortunate one just because it's a stock of concern. They've been trying to get the numbers of those musk ox up for quite a few years now, and they've been down, and they've been trying to figure out why that stock is down, you know, in numbers. So to lose some from that, and one was a collared musk ox that had been harvested, it really hurts the stock, especially when they're trying to get them healthy.
Dahl says there are suspects in the investigation, and he has contacted them. Alaska Department of Fish and Game research biologist Steve Arthur says the number of musk oxen in this specific herd peaked in the mid-1990s at around 650 animals. Now it's less than a third of that.
They've reached a point now where there's fewer than 200 musk oxen in this part of Alaska, and the numbers are getting small enough where, you know, every individual animal becomes that much more important.
Additionally, Arthur says there are only around 80 to 85 adult cows in the herd. He says at least one of the 4 musk oxen killed this week in Nuiqsut was a cow. Some subsistence users on the North Slope have testified at wildlife meetings recently about their concerns that musk oxen can repel caribou herds and cause problems with hunting when they get close to town. Trooper Dan Dahl says he isn't aware of a connection between this concern and the illegal harvest this week. Steve Arthur says although he's fairly sure human killing of musk oxen does happen from time to time, this case is definitely unique.
Well, there's been a number of instances where we suspected something like this might have happened, but we haven't had such conclusive evidence, eyewitnesses basically. You know, all we can say is that we suspect that it does happen, but it's really hard to say if it's a very common thing. I don't think it's common, but, you know, it certainly does happen.
Arthur says he and his colleagues have been trying to figure out the reason for the herd's decline for 3 to 4 years. He says he doesn't suspect intentional human killings play a big role in the decline, but that it's likely a number of other factors. Trooper Dan Dahl says he can't give any further information about suspects or the investigation at this point. Currently, there is no open season for muskox harvest. In Barrow, I'm Jake Neer.
Southeast Alaska charter halibut operators are facing new restrictions. Clients on their boats can now only keep fish up to 37 inches long. That's on top of an existing one halibut per day limit imposed in 2009. The new rule from NOAA's Fisheries Service is part of a larger effort to address dwindling stocks. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The off-season is the time when fishing lodges book many of their summer clients. Southeast Alaska Guides Organization President Tom O'House says it's been rough going this time around.
I just talked to somebody who's an operator out of Petersburg, and he had four calls from new people over the last week, and all four of them were interested in booking a trip. And when they found out that there was going to be a maximum size limit, three of the four groups backed out.
The 37-inch limit was made official Friday. Spokeswoman Julie Spiegel says NOAA Fisheries is implementing recommendations from the International Pacific Halibut Commission. They were based on analysis and methods adopted by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council.
The halibut stock is declining. We've got fewer fish that are reaching a catchable size range, and also the higher-than-target harvest rates are having an impact on the fish.
The decision affects charter halibut operators in what's called Area 2C. That includes all of Southeast Alaska south of Yakutat. The rest of the state has a two-fish quota with no size limit. The rule is part of an ongoing effort to rein in charter fleets' harvests, which have exceeded limits for years. A one-fish-a-day rule in place last season still left operators over their harvest level by 62%. Charter harvests are supposed to be limited to 788,000 pounds this year. The new length rule is in effect until it's changed, but Spiegel says her agency will ask regulatory bodies to consider upping the limit to 42 inches.
We understand this is going to have an impact on their business this season, and because of that, NOAA Fisheries intends to ask the council to review the methodology used to determine the maximum size limits.
Lodges and other charter operators say the limit is scaring away business. Tom O'House of the Guides Organization says people marketing tours at trade fairs are facing stiff competition.
Any show that has people from other sections of the state of Alaska there who can offer two halibut per day of any size versus one per day of perhaps 37 inches, it's a no-brainer. That's not a marketable position.
O'House doubts anyone plans to take the size limit to court. He says no one can afford the cost of legal action. Halibut numbers are actually up, but their size is down. Researchers say the exploitable biomass, made up of fish big enough to harvest, dropped by half during the past decade. The charter limit is just one of several ongoing efforts to protect halibut.
This isn't going to be easy for anybody this year.
Kathy Hansen heads up the Southeast Alaska Fishermen's Alliance. She says it's time for the charter fleet to stay within prescribed limits, as commercial longliners already do.
This management measure will hopefully function to keep the charter industry within their allocation, just as the commercial sector has to stay within their allocation. It's an unfortunate situation for both gear groups that our resources declined this far and that everybody's having to face such severe economic hardships.
Commercial fishermen are seeing a 47% drop in their share of the catch this year. That's in addition to a 60% reduction over the previous 5 years. Charter operators face another major restriction this year. A new limited entry system is expected to reduce their fleet by 40%. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A riff between the Lesnoy Native Corporation and a timber company contracted to log around Chiniac spilled into the courts last week after A1 Timber filed a lawsuit alleging breach of contract. The move comes amid the surfacing of a telephone recording in which Lesnoy leadership brags about a plan to oust the timber company and bankrupt its owners. KMXT's Jacob Resnick reports.
An excerpt from a conversation between Lesnoy's leadership and an Idaho-based timber consultant has garnered nearly 3,000 hits since it was posted on YouTube last week. The conversation was back in November when Frontier Timber of Post Falls, Idaho was embroiled in a lawsuit with A1 Timber's Tom Lachine. In the tape, Lesnoy CEO Carol Pagano and her husband Leonard Zeiser discussed their plans to force Tom Lachine out and take over the Kodiak logging operations themselves.
They were trying to do this job on their own, but from the very beginning, they were, their plan was to bring a logger in and get everything set up and then basically throw them to the wolves once they got some money in their account.
That's Clarence Mackey of Frontier Timber who recorded the call.
And I thought, that's just not right, no matter who it is. I mean, I was in a lawsuit with the company he was talking about, but I still didn't think that that was right.
State laws in Idaho and Alaska allow a telephone conversation to be legally recorded, provided one of the parties consents. On the call, Maxie can be heard expressing his surprise that relations between Lesnoy and A1 had gotten so bad.
I thought you guys were in hog heaven. Your money was rolling in and you were happy with Tom and everything was going great. I had no idea that... So you played a pretty straight face.
Well, I had to. My whole goal was to get this thing financed by Tom this way and then toss him to the wolves when it was time and go do this ourselves.
All of these revelations come as the Chiniac logging operation has been at a standstill since December. Last May, Lesnoy and A1 Timber agreed to a $15 million deal in which 100 million board feet of logs from Kodiak would be cut and shipped to Asian markets. A1 Timber says only a tenth of the lumber has been harvested since operations were suspended 3 months ago. Lesnoy CEO Carol Pagano declined to comment and referred questions to attorney Bill Ingoldson. Ingoldson says the allegations made against the Village Corporation are false and that it was A1 Timber that had breached the contract, leading to suspended operations at Chiniac. And last week's release of phone tapes, he says, is part of a smear campaign against the Village Corporation.
When we were still negotiating and discussing and had resolved a lot of differences and there was some optimism, maybe this will work, this YouTube video comes out. And that was planned. That was obviously planned. And you have to wonder what type of person would do something like that and in the middle of negotiations, and why is it being done?
Last week, A1 Timber filed a lawsuit against Lesnoy, alleging that last October, Leonard Zeiser threatened to kill the contract unless A1 pay a premium from profits. The lawsuit says Tom Lachine refused to pay, and from the November telephone tapes, it's apparent that relations had deteriorated. Here's Zeiser talking to Maxie.
Every time that Tom comes around us, and even when he's not around us, he's spreading rumors about us, which are obviously untruths.
Uh-huh.
And we figured Tom out long, long time ago, but we needed this revenue, to get the corporation up and going again. And we were just waiting for the moment to put him under. And he's doing it, obviously, to himself.
He's doing it to himself, exactly.
Maxie denies any financial interest in either Lesnoy or A1. Meanwhile, A1's lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Anchorage seeks at least $75,000 in damages, plus an injunction forcing Lesnoy to allow logging to resume. In Kodiak, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Filmmakers are not new to the village of Talkeetna, but this month brings the first zombie horror film set entirely in Alaska and Talkeetna. Dozens of people showed up to a casting call last Monday afternoon. KTNA's Sue Dio was at the auditions and has more.
Who wants to be a zombie? Just line up right over there.
That's independent filmmaker Joe Davison. Monday afternoon in Talkeetna brought dozens of people to the Sheldon Community Arts Hangar to audition for a part in Frostbite, a horror movie set in the future, filmed almost entirely in the Talkeetna area. Actors and actresses from Anchorage showed up to audition, as well as the local theatrical crowd. Well-known horror movie aficionado Eric Martin, was at the head of the pack.
Paper, glass, metal, bullets, you name it, it was in the air. Blood hit me in the face. I'd never seen so much blood.
24 people tried out for speaking parts, and another 40 or 50 people signed up for non-speaking zombie roles. After wrapping up auditions, Davison and local theatrical producer Nick Condon spoke about the movie.
It's going to be a big cast. I think there's 15 people in the cast.
That's just speaking roles, though.
Just speaking roles, plus zombies. So it's very much like Mad Max meets Dawn of the Dead.
Max of the Dead.
Max of the Dead.
Davison was drawn to Talkeetna to visit his ailing father. As he started making plans to visit Alaska, thoughts formed in his head about a horror movie set in small-town Alaska. He contacted his brother, who lives in Talkeetna as well. In turn, Condon was contacted.
And I talked to Nick through some emails, and we talked on the phone a couple times. And Nick really, like, got the town going for the movie. And the turnout's been crazy.
He said it became clear when he landed in Alaska that his film could be great.
Like, when I got off the plane, you know, there's this giant bay window at the airport in Anchorage. And you just see these mountain ranges, and you're just like, I was like, oh, my God. But when you're coming down whatever main road this is, what road is it?
We have one road. It's the road.
Well, when you're driving down the road that everyone does, and you see Mount McKinley in the background, or in the foreground as you're coming towards it, there's no words to explain that feeling.
Davison's company, Pop Gun Pictures, is based in Tampa Bay, Florida. Their films have been selected for close to 24 independent film festivals around the world. Filming begins next week. Davison was astounded with the turnout Monday and is excited about and grateful for the warm hospitality he's received as he tries to find the best filming locations.
We haven't had one issue. Everyone has welcomed their establishment or their house. You know, we just walk in and ask and tell them what we're doing, and they're like, zombies, yeah! We're like, woohoo!
And there are people literally lined up outside today waiting to be a zombie. I mean, people want to be a zombie.
Who doesn't want to be a zombie?
Frostbite is due to be released before the end of 2011. In Talkeetna, I'm Sue Dio.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Deanna Hecker on the Iditarod Trail, Jake Neer in Barrow, Jacob Resnick in Kodiak, and Sue Dio in Talkeetna. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. We also had help tonight from Josh Edge. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, providing financial tools and resources for purchasing a home or planning for the future. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Indian Trust Indian Trust Biugovit aging you mountain Illinic $3.4 billion settlement dam. Agochtoyugovit alangamak settlement dam kanging narotinic. Biunakochivnik kanacht darvikun. Website amun IndianTrust.com amun Biu mountain. Hwaltoklogu 1-800-961-6109.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.